Brahma, and one day of Brahma consists of 1,000 cycles of 4 yugas or ages, Satya, Treta, Dwarpa, and Kali. The cycle of sattva is characterized by virtue, wisdom, and religion, there being practically no ignorance and vice. And the yuga lasts 1,728,000 years. In the Treta Yuga, vice is introduced, and in this yuga, there is 1,296,000 years. In the Dwarpa Yuga, there's an even greater decline in virtue and religion, vice increasing, and this yuga lasts 864,000 years. And finally, in Kali Yuga, the yuga we have now been experiencing over the past 5,000 years, there is an abundance of strife, ignorance, irreligion, and vice, true virtue being practically non-existent. This yuga lasts 432,000 years. In Kali Yuga, vice increases to such a point that at the termination of the yuga, the Supreme Lord himself appears as the Kalki avatar, vanquishes the demons, saves his devotees, and commences another Satya Yuga. Then the process is set rolling again. These 4 yugas, rotating 1,000 times, comprise one day of Brahma, and the same number comprise one night. Brahma lives 100 of such years and then dies. These 100 years of earth calculations total to 311,040,000,000,000 earth years. By these calculations, the life of Brahma seems fantastic and interminable. But from the viewpoint of eternity, it is as brief as a lightning flash. In the causal ocean, there are innumerable Brahmas rising and disappearing like bubbles in the Atlantic. Brahma and his creator are all part of the material universe, and therefore they are in constant flux. In the material universe, not even Brahma is free from the process of birth, old age, disease, and death. Brahma, however, is directly engaged in the service of the Supreme Lord and the management of this universe. Therefore, he at once attains liberation. Elevated sannyasis are promoted to Brahma's particular planet, Brahmaloka, which is the highest planet in the material universe, and which survives all the heavenly planets in the upper strata of the planetary system. But in due course, Brahma and all the inhabitants of Brahmaloka are subject to death according to the law of material nature. Next verse is, at the beginning of Brahma's day, all living entities become manifest from the unmanifest state, and thereafter, when the night falls, they are merged into the unmanifest for 311,040,000,000,000 years of our years, and that's the lifetime of Brahma. And within that, we have regular, smaller cycles. We have the years, just as we have years that go in cycles of, you know, seasons every year, and then comes back to the same point and start again with spring and summer and autumn and winter, and go through the cycle. And this is how we count our years. So we have days and years of Brahma. He has 100 years like this, and in the year he has days. This is, we have night and day cycles here within the year. We have night and day cycles also. So there are night and day cycles for Brahma also. And each day and night is comprised of 1,000 yuga cycles. Of Satya, Treta, Dwarpa, and Kali. And 1,000 of those go around, that is one day. And then we have 1,000 for the night. So there's another cycle of day and night for Lord Brahma. And within that, we got the 1,000 cycles going on of rotations of yugas for 1,000 times. Even that is further divided up into smaller units. And there's manvantara periods within the day of Brahma, 14 of those take place in one Brahma's day, different periods. And of course, within each yuga, then of course we get the years going by. And probably they're all smaller cycles within the big cycles of the yugas also. Astrologically, at least, we plot out smaller cycles like Jupiter cycles or Saturn cycles or whatever also. And finally, we get down to the year cycle. For ourselves. And in terms of individual life, of course, we do have our life cycle, which runs, technically should go up to 100 years, but usually doesn't. Huh? So each individual has a cycle in his life also. And then he dies, and then the soul goes into the body, and it gets another cycle. So we have life cycles for ourselves, and within that we got smaller cycles of time also, until we get down to the days, and then we get down to the hours, etc. And Bhagavatam divides it up into portions of seconds, etc., muhurtas, and smaller divisions of time also. So we find in the Vedic literature this idea of division of time up from the smallest to the very greatest. And when we start getting bigger and bigger sections of time, it usually runs in cycles. We have life cycles up until we get Brahma's life cycle. And of course, after that, a life cycle of Lord Brahma, when he disappears and dies, then there's a rest period. And then again, Brahma is born, or many Brahmas are born, many universes, and then we get, again, manifestation of Brahma's life. So, and this goes on continually, and then Brahmas are appearing and disappearing again and again and again. So we get these cycles from the smallest cycle up to the largest cycle taking place with no beginning and no end. It goes on like this. We can't trace out when it started, nor can we say when it will end. And this, of course, we visualize as Mahavishnu lying down on the causal ocean in his yoga nidra, and he's breathing in and out, and the universes flow out of his body, and then again they disappear back into him again, and they flow out again, and they disappear again like this. And this goes on continually. So this is an explanation of the, we can say, the creation and dissolution of universes, manifestation and disappearance of matter. Science, of course, has something similar to this. Of course, science is very speculative now when we come to cosmology and astronomy, etc. But they have some sort of theory that there's also expansion and contraction of the universe eternally. It goes on like this. Difference, of course, is that in our picture here of the universe, there's a personality there behind it that is Mahavishnu. And of course, behind that, Mahavishnu, of course, is there in terms of manifestation of the material worlds. And then behind that, of course, we have the will of the Lord. And on behind that, we got the spiritual world going on in another sphere beyond the material world, completely separate. We have Mahavishnu sleeping there, one form of the Lord, and then we have the spiritual world going on separately. There's a plan behind the whole thing. The Lord has a specific plan in all these cycles of time that go on within the material realm. That's not there in the scientific view. Ultimately, there's nothing beyond the cycles of expansion and contraction of the universe. How it is taking place or why it's taking place, they won't say. But we say, well, why it's taking place is by the will of the Lord. It is the Lord's breathing, and by the Lord's will, he manifests the universe. And then the whole purpose of the universe is to put the jivas in the universe, to put the souls in the universe. And that the universe won't exist unless it's for the purpose of the souls. The only reason the Lord manifests the universe is to put the souls in the universe so they can enjoy. If they don't want to enjoy, he won't make a universe. So therefore, it is actually for the souls. And of course, in the modern world, modern science, they don't accept the soul at all. So therefore, the world in that sense has no purpose. Because there's no souls at all. And there's no God also. So therefore, from our point of view, the world has a purpose in terms of what the Lord's purpose, plus the for the enjoyment of the jivas and our purpose is enjoyment, and the Lord's purpose is to get us out of the enjoyment, put us here and then somehow get us out of this enjoyment. But we see it's a very long process, and therefore there's this whole cycle of Brahma's lifetime, which is 311 trillion years, 40 billion years, and it goes on like that. And it's repetitive, that goes on forever. And within that, the jivas are getting in there each time and wandering around in the universe. So this is a very vast picture of creation and destruction, which goes on like this. It says they are manifest when the day is there, and then unmanifest when the night falls. So there's a big destruction, and then there's a little destruction in the day and nights of Brahma. And then the smaller cycles are there in terms of yuga cycles. We have all these cycles which are quite precisely described of time. It's difficult to talk about the big ones because they're so large we can't even conceive of what it is. But when it comes down to, you know, Satya Treta Dwarpa Kali, then of course it becomes a little bit more manageable for us. And that's when we begin to become a little bit maybe doubtful. How is it possible? Because from the scientific point of view, you know, we have fossil records and things like that, and archaeology, and it doesn't say that there was a better civilization before millions of years ago. In other words, we trace man back as cavemen so many 100,000 years ago, and they developed into different forms like Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal and whatever. And then finally we get cities forming, where we get the so-called modern man coming out in ancient Sumeria and other places, those cultures, and then Indus Valley in India and Egypt, and that's happening maybe 5,000 or 3,000 years ago. That's the beginning of modern civilization from modern textbooks. And before that was nothing. So then that looks a little different from what we find here, where we find actually this is a lesser culture of what we have now. This is a Kali Yuga culture, degraded culture. And I think it was 2012 or something? 2112 or 2012 BC, before Christ, that was technically the beginning of Kali Yuga. So in other words, 5,000 some odd years before it was the beginning of Kali Yuga. Before that was Dwarpa Yuga. That was supposed to be a better time. But we're saying it's that only civilization begins about 5,000 years ago. And before that, nothing. Just cavemen and stuff. But the Vedas are saying, no, it's the opposite. They were more advanced before that. And before that, more advanced. Until we go back, 4 million years, beginning of Satya Yuga. 4 million years ago, and that was very, very, very elevated then. So we have this idea here of a declining civilization until we get to the modern age. Whereas from the scientific view, it's the opposite. We start from the primitive, and we're gradually evolving up into more advanced forms now. And this is we're the most advanced now. So it's like an opposite conception there. So it's a contradiction. Of course, the modern people say this is all like mythology. But interesting enough, we have this same sort of concept in other places in Greek mythology. We have a similar type of thing with the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age. They have a similar concept there also. And of course, there's the famous quote by Plato that some time ago, I don't know what year he puts that at, but anyway, there was another civilization there that got destroyed called Atlantis, and that's where the whole Atlantis story comes from. He makes one reference in one place that there was another place and it got destroyed, went under the water so many years ago. So he said there were previous civilizations also, and this of course is not accepted by modern archaeology, etc. However, people always have theories about this, where is Atlantis, and they try to find it. Nobody's really found it so far, but they have all sorts of theories about this also. We have very, very divergent theories also about where it is. Anyway, we have this sort of contradictory idea here of we're advancing, but then Vedas say we're going backwards. Backwards in the sense that, as explained here in the purport by Prabhupada, there's more materialism and less spiritualism. We're not necessarily defining in terms of, tape recorders and television and things like this and airplanes and this type of material airplanes and rocket ships and all this. But in terms of spiritual, there's a decline. However, at the same time, we should not think that all of these conclusions of modern scientists and whatever are so definite. We should not always think that, because a lot of their conclusions are not based upon solid facts. They're based upon wishful thinking. In other words, they think it should be like this, and that's how they conclude. Of course, we will think that they are doing it scientifically, but actually, if we look at the records, it is not so scientific after all. And that is exactly what Dhritakarma and Sataputta have tried to prove in this forbidden archaeology, in which they go over the records of archaeology, which is supposed to be done scientifically. But they find there's a lot of irregularities in their way they accept or reject things, to slant everything towards this idea of cavemen developing gradually in a certain form and then becoming more civilized. When, in actual fact, we will find a lot of contradiction in this sort of idea of evolution from one form to the more advanced forms of skulls, etc. It doesn't always look like that according to the actual records. And moreover, we find contradictions there also. And we'll find examples of artifacts which are more modern than anything of a caveman, predating the caveman relics. And there's examples of that, things that were found, but they get rejected as being, it can't be like that because it's impossible. Because it's not our theory. Therefore, we don't accept this evidence. So this is the idea. In other words, they're not really giving. Whereas other things which support their theory of primitive to advanced over the last so many, thousands of years, they'll accept those things when the evidence there also is not so strong. But they'll expect stronger evidence for the things which contradict their theory, and therefore they reject those things. If that evidence isn't, if the conditions are not met, therefore we say that's not evidence. But they'll accept the other evidence on weaker grounds, weaker conditions, if it supports their theory. So that's his main thesis in this whole big thing. And he gives examples of this, many, many examples of this in this book, Forbidden Archaeology. But one sense we call cheating, intellectual cheating. They don't have an unbiased approach to the subject. It's very biased. And so therefore they accept things which fit their theory and they reject things that don't fit it, even though the evidence is just as strong in the opposite direction. So that is what he points out there. So therefore we should not be a little wary of all of this when we think, oh, it's proven fact that it happened like this. So it's not proven at all. So even the theory of evolution, in fact, nobody's ever proved it, and they've never got the missing links together to show man advancing and changing from, evolving out of monkeys and whatever, or some other form. They haven't got the missing links there altogether. They haven't got so many missing links there for development of simple structures in the organisms, like the eye. They don't have a model for that in the fossils of developing an eye. It's not there. Suddenly it's just there. How it got there, nobody knows. But according to the theory of evolution, it would have to evolve from some simple little thing, some one-celled thing. But there's no evidence that it did. So of course, there's many, many examples of this and many forms of very, very complicated things that happen in our bodies that you cannot explain by evolution. It's impossible to explain it. And of course, even mathematicians, when they come down to evolution, they say we cannot accept it, because mathematics never proves evolution. It can't. It's just so difficult to prove this by mathematics. It wouldn't happen. It could not happen. Because of the complexity of the organisms now and the time they had to evolve to that complexity, cannot happen by evolution. It's too much. So, what is the alternative, of course, is that there's some other factor there which is making things happen in certain ways. Of course, we do accept the fact that the animals change and so many things die out, species die out, and other ones replace them. That we can accept. But how do things change? Not by chance. There's some will and some plan behind all of this also. Not by chance alone. So that's where we have the idea. We have the Supreme Person who was the, master planner behind everything, behind all the yuga cycles and everything, and behind all the species, changing forms and appearing and disappearing, whatever, and with a certain plan in mind. So the time, of course, is again in cycles with a certain plan behind it. It's done in a regular fashion, and there's a plan there. Anyway, the evidence that we got for our so-called modern theories is not so foolproof after all, if we look at it. So we should not be so convinced by it and think that the Vedic version is simply a fairy tale or something like that. When we have so much, if we examine closely, we see that the facts are a little bit different from what we think they are. We have these contradictions to the theories. Sometimes they're absurdly contradictory. For instance, we have in fossil records, we'll have dinosaurs, things like that. Before the dinosaurs was the Carboniferous period, when you had all the jungles and stuff and that, and then they got turned into coal. All the coal is made out of these plants. They got turned into carbon. After that, then you get the dinosaurs, and after the dinosaurs, then you get the warm-blooded creatures. So that's our scenario, and that takes millions and millions of years to go on. So you cannot expect to find a human being when there's a dinosaur, or a dinosaur when there's the Carboniferous period. They're too far apart. But yet, you'll find in the fossil records. Sometimes there is this one record there where there's a human footprint next to a dinosaur footprint or something like that, which sounds ridiculous. So that's what they say. It's not. It can't be. Cannot be, because according to our theory, the warm-blooded creatures could not be there when the dinosaurs were there. They were there completely millions of years apart, and even though any warm-blooded creature was not alive then when those things were around. So what to speak of a fully developed human being with a footprint fossilized next to a dinosaur footprint? That sounds ridiculous, So therefore they just reject it outright. It's not possible. but nevertheless, those things are there. Records are there. There's one man in America, somewhere on the East Coast or something, he bought a coal mine, extinct coal mine. Somebody had a coal mine and it was not profitable or something, so the man was selling it. So he got this coal mine and it's on his property. So then he saw all these things on his, they saw these fossils in the coal, and in the coal itself he found all sorts of strange things which shouldn't be there, because the coal period was before the dinosaurs, and the dinosaurs were before the human being. But within the coal he's found like saber-toothed tigers and things like that. Huge creatures, huge ones, really big, with huge bones and everything. And moreover, he's found human remains also in the same coal. And not only that, he found implements also fossilized in the coal, like tools of the human beings. And of course, the human being's skull also is very big. It's not like ours, it's much bigger than ours. So he's found these artifacts. He says he sent them. He sent photographs to the Smithsonian Institute to tell them to come investigate all these things. But he said they don't reply. They don't want to come. He says they refuse to come. Because they think it's all, you know, it's not real. It can't be real. Because it's so contradictory to the, you know, what we think is the, you know, the fossil record and the theory of evolution, etc. Like that. So, you know, that's one thing. So in his book, Sariputta gives some other examples of how artifacts are found in the wrong time frame, you know. Completely wrong time frame, things are found, and we can't accept them because, you know, how could a human being be alive at that time? One example is in America, I think. They were digging for gold, you know, gold mines. They go into the mountain and drill up mountains and stuff like that. And you go through layers and layers and layers of, you know, things to go down there. And of course, in geologists, they can measure the, you know, the time periods by the, you know, the layers and everything like that. So if you go down for the gold, that's not, you know, that's millions and millions of years ago way down there under the earth. But when they went down and were digging in the coal mines or the gold mines down there, they found artifacts down there. You know, carved artifacts. Under all of that, you know, layers and layers and layers going down hundreds and hundreds of feet, which means millions and millions of years ago, they found, you know, like carved bowls and other artifacts down there. So how that can be? So they don't accept it. Even though there's witnesses that said this is what we found down there, we chipped it out of the, you know, the sediment and like this. But, we won't accept it. So there are many documented cases like that where people found things. But they say, well, it wasn't done by a professional, it wasn't done by an archaeologist, we're not going to accept it because somebody else found it. But, you know, like this. So we do contradictions like that to show that maybe our modern, you know, theory of this whole thing is not quite correct. Now, according to the Vedas, of course, you see in Srimad Bhagavatam that we don't have this type of, you know, evolution of humankind from nothing all the way up to primitive species all the way up to modern, because the civilized human being was created at the beginning of the day of Brahma, which is, 4 million times, I don't know, something. Anyway, billions of years ago. And each day he populates the different planetary systems with the different creatures, including the human beings. Every day of Brahma it happens. So that would put the civilizations back billions and billions of years, not 100,000 years or 5,000 years or whatever, but it puts it back billions of years, which of course nobody wants to accept in the modern world. So where's the evidence? No fossil records. And of course then we get the human beings and civilizations going in cycles, and it gets destroyed, obviously. At the end of Kali Yuga comes, everything gets more or less destroyed, and then we get Satya Yuga coming out, and then Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, and Kali Yuga, and within that we get so many destructions also, the changes, shifts of periods. So we cannot expect that everything is going to be there in proper shape. And of course we know that the Earth, the planet itself, goes through many, many changes through history. Even recently it's gone through great change. And that is, we had an ice age 12,000 years ago, which is not very far back actually, when you think of it. 12,000 years ago was an ice age. And before that, the whole Earth looked quite a lot different, because parts of the Earth which are now very icy were very tropical at that time. For instance, Siberia was tropical at one time, and it had, you know, mammoths were up there playing around eating the jungly leaves and everything like that. And parts of the world were above water which are now underwater. So the Earth looked quite a lot different only 12,000 years ago. So to change so drastically, there had to be big upheaval in the Earth, at which point a lot of things could have got destroyed. So this of course is borne out now in modern discoveries. We do find that just recently, they discovered in India off the coast there. Of course, in the last few years ago, they also discovered that there is a Nirdwarka under the water there. There is a city, which is like maybe 5,000 years old, which will correspond to Dwarka, Krishna's Dwarka, or whatever. But then, just a few months ago, they discovered another city out there, which is maybe 12,000 years old, or at least over 7,000 years old. But they had some artifacts, and I think they dated it, went back 12,000 years, from carbon dating. So based on that, scholars have said, archaeologists said, well, if that is the case, then it is true that the dating is correct, then we have to rewrite everything in the history of, civilization, because it goes, our whole theory is, completely finished now. We've got to understand that there were civilizations a long time ago, maybe before the Ice Age, because it was only after the Ice Age or during the Ice Age that everything sunk down there, and there are some radical changes. So therefore, this shows that before the Ice Age, there must have been higher civilizations, which are more likely wiped out now under the water, and that's why we don't see them. So this is just one modern thing that came out. Interesting enough, at the same time, they also discovered, of course they knew something was probably there by legend anyway, that's in South India near Madras, this city called Mahabalipuram. That's a tourist attraction now, the things there. But that only goes back maybe to 2,000 years at most right now. But they have a legend that actually a lot of the cities under the water, and there were seven temples there, now there's only one temple on the shore. So they just discovered also a few months ago there is a city under the water there. Also there, which must have sunk sometime within the last few thousand years again. Apart from that, we find other things, discoveries. They haven't confirmed it yet, but they think it's there. That is off the coast of Cuba. They were doing some, sonar type things, discovery, and it looks like there's a city under there also. And by the, the little forms, they haven't gone down there with scuba gear or anything yet to see. The one in, of course, India is more positive because they actually got artifacts out of the place, everything. But the one in Cuba, they haven't gone down and got anything yet. But from the sonar and out, it looks like there's definitely some patterns of things down there which are not quite, natural. They're regular forms down there under the ocean. So off the coast of Cuba, it looks like something also sunk down there. So that's another thing that was just discovered a few months ago, but not really confirmed. And then off the coast of in Japan, in Okinawa, a few years ago, this has been going on for some time, still controversial from some people, they don't really accept it, but the one diver discovered off the coast of Okinawa when he was diving, and then it looked like what he saw down there was like structures under the ocean, like pyramids and things like that. They have photos of them. Somehow they're attached to the actual rock structure, so it's a little bit difficult to tell whether it's only natural formations or whether it's actual. But they do have very odd angles on them and rims and things like that, and there's a few holes in certain places like that, and there's platforms, but they're not so regular. They're kind of irregularly formed, but definitely it looks very strange for natural phenomena to come out in that way. So there's a lot of these things down there under the water. And again, they say, both people that discovered them and studied them said, no, they have to be, they cannot be natural things, they're actually man-made. But they only sunk down, it would have to be before 12,000 years ago. Because according to the geological reference, that's the last ice age, that's when it sank down. So those forms would have to be over 12,000 years ago also. And another area of research in Egypt, we all know about the Sphinx, The Sphinx is there. And according to modern theory, it was probably built about maybe 3,000 something years ago, maybe, along with the pyramids. However, some geologists went and studied in detail the face and the body of that Sphinx. And he noted that it is eroded in a certain way. And it's not by the wind either. It's by water. And constant submerging in water for maybe 100 years would only cause the erosion of the Sphinx in that way. He said it cannot be caused by anything else. But the only time that the water was there was also over 12,000 years ago. So therefore the Sphinx had to be carved previous to that in order to get submerged 12,000 years ago for 100 years or so. So then he says, therefore it must be older. And if the pyramids were only built later, then this had to be there previously. And it was not from the Egyptians, this previous civilization. Because the Egyptians were only maybe 4,000 years or 3,000 years back. So it had to be there before. So somebody else built those things. So we get these little evidences or little details popping up now and then. And this latest one in Dwarka is pretty interesting because it's quite definite that there is a city under there, and if they date it that much back, then that will definitely make people think again about the where civilization came from and when it arose or whatever. So these are just some evidences or to show that this whole idea that everything started 5,000 years ago or less is not actually true. And the Vedic version that is much, much older is probably in fact true. Along with this, of course, we do get strange discoveries in different places of the world. Not only that the people existed, but that they may have had very advanced civilizations in many ways. Different instruments are found, ancient instruments are found which are quite sophisticated. In Greece they found one instrument there, a very accurate instrument for calculating movements of planets and things, with all movable parts in it. A very, very sophisticated instrument. It has to be several thousand years old. And of course, we find in Vedic times, and actually ancient civilizations in general, were very interested in the sky. And a lot of their present monuments are also orientated, according to astronomical considerations. That's been studied also. All these temples and other pyramids, of course, are oriented towards certain stars in the sky. And cities themselves are oriented. Stonehenge also, of course, has got some relationship with eclipses and things like that. And we know that, the ancient civilizations, Egyptians, Sumerians, Babylonians, Vedic culture, they all studied astrology and astronomy. And they're always calculating, the movements of planets in the sky for some strange reason. Whereas modern civilization, you ask anybody on the street, they don't know anything about anything in the sky. You look up at the sky, they don't know what's there. But these ancient people, for some reason, were very fascinated with the sky. And they recorded all the stars and the constellations. They had names for them, the visions, divided it up into 12 sections of the zodiac and everything. And then they started calculating the movements of the different planets, like Venus, Mercury, and Jupiter, and all these things. And they got the mathematics where they could actually predict when the planets are going to be in certain places in the sky. And that's what we call astronomy. And then from that, they got astrology, which is interpreting those things in terms of, human karma, human events, which is a little bit of a leap for scientists. But anyway, they applied this. One of the uses was for astrology, for getting the movements of planets, etc. This also advanced and to a considerable degree, this looking at the skies and calculations, etc. Very advanced in Vedic culture. To do that, you have to have advanced mathematics. to calculate exact movements of planets. So they had exact advanced mathematics there and everything for that purpose. They had advanced sciences, and of course, what we have, of course, the modern person can look at this as, okay, fine, it's just, you know, mathematics or whatever, but also what we have now obviously could only be remnants of something else, because if there was destruction so many thousands of years ago, where we have whole civilizations disappearing under the water, obviously all the science goes with it. So what we get after that with the modern civilizations of 5,000 years ago, Indus civilization and Egyptian and Babylonian, is just the remnants of that. Just like if today suddenly everything blew up and you got a few people left, what kind of science are going to have? They don't know anything. Most people don't know anything about anything. So they have to start over from scratch again. And they may have a little hint of what was up there or whatever, you know, what knowledge was, but very little. So what's coming down, of course, now is maybe scant. It's not the full knowledge. It's only something that we get nowadays from Vedic culture or whatever. It's the remnants of something else probably that's much more advanced before. So anyway, this we should think twice about the modern theories of culture, etc., when we see this happening. And as I said, the Vedic idea is that human beings are always there. And they may disappear at some time or get half annihilated, and then the civilization has to start all over again. So it looks like that's what we see nowadays. It's a modern civilization is only the remnants of a previous civilization, that's all, which got mostly wiped out over 12,000 years ago or whatever. So that's one thing. There's an interesting side note, of course, several things. A lot of people believe in the ancient cultures now through channeling and things like this, the Atlantis civilization and so many things like that. It was quite common belief. There was an Atlantean civilization. Theosophists particularly believe this, that was Atlantis civilization. Before that, there was a Lemurian civilization, different parts of the globe which are now underwater. But in Russia, there was one. She's a psychiatrist. She tells this is true, according to her experience, that she met one other scientist there in Siberia. She was a Siberian psychiatrist. And she met one man there who was in the research department, in the physics department there, a special category for people who are, you know, very special and intelligent doing research like that. Get special privileges. So he began researching into time and going back in time, actually. So he invented this machine or something you could get into, and then you would start recollecting previous things, you know, like that. It was like a, made out of mirrors or something. You go inside that and suddenly you kind of end up in a different dimension or something, and then you start remembering things, and you record these different memories you have. He had some idea that actually in that area of Siberia, actually it was at one time a very advanced civilization there. And they do have fossil records that it was tropical at one time and things like that. And 12,000 years ago, it turned into ice. The mammoth himself froze probably within a few days. And that because they can even now get them. They're not fossilized, they're just frozen, that's all. Frozen mammoths from 12,000 years ago. So they froze in a few days, you know, like that. Suddenly it got cold and they just froze up like that. With the food in their mouth in some cases, fresh food in their mouth. So it was a very sudden change of climate, it looks like. And suddenly it became like deep freezer, you know, and they just froze. And even the dogs, when they get these creatures, the dogs eat the meat sometimes. You know, the wild dogs and wolves, when they find one, it's thawed out. It was a very sudden change of climate from a very tropical climate at one time. Anyway, the man put the psychiatrist lady into this thing, machine, and then she went back and did a whole thing. And then her whole experience was that there was a civilization there in that area at one time. And it was highly advanced in terms of spiritual intuition and things like that. Not maybe by our modern means of, you know, buildings and cities and scientific inventions and material comforts like that. Huh? It may look primitive in that sense, you know. But in terms of understanding, you know, spirit and matter and God and all this, it was quite advanced. And then at a certain point in time, they understood that climate is going to shift, Earth is going to shift and everything. So then the civilization began to move out of there, and they moved to other parts of Europe and down into India. That's the message you got anyway, like that. So then this man developed this theory that the original culture came from Siberia, actually, before the Ice Age, and then it shifted to other parts of Europe and to India and into the Mesopotamian Valley after that, Egypt, all these other places that came afterwards, after they shifted out of Siberia. Anyway, that's his theory. Whatever. That's at the day, beginning of the day of Brahma. And it's for those persons who are ready, those jivas who are ready to, you know, advance and go to a spiritual level. That's what the whole human species is for. So therefore, we do have in Sapta Yuga, we have advanced spiritual life, and this is the normal situation of the human being. And as we get degraded in Kali Yuga, and everyone forgets, and so on. Now, after the last Ice Age, everyone's forgotten about spiritual life, and we get a few remnants there in terms of Egyptian and other cultures of the world, somewhat spiritual, but a little bit vague and confused, you know. And then the modern world, of course, now we even reject those things. And basically, scientists, the most, you know, thoughtful people, don't believe in spirit and God at all. But the psychiatrist, her interest was actually that, not so much in that culture which is there, but the idea that the remnants were still there in one form, passed down in the shamanic culture of Siberia. And in that culture, she found that, because it's very like secretive, you know, and it's carried on from relative to relative, it doesn't go out of their little group. So therefore it's very selective and very secret, and they don't tell anybody about it, you know, because, you know, the Christians or the different cultures will suppress it. So they're all hiding in the mountains like that. Anyway, she found some shamans like this, you know. And then what she learned was ultimately that they were very spiritually advanced. And that they accepted the idea that you're not the body, you're the soul. And that was shocking to her, because she didn't even believe in the soul, because she was, you know, brought up in atheist communist Russia, and, you know, all her theories about, you know, mind and body and all this stuff, you know, all modern theories about, you know, how to cure people of, you know, psychosis or whatever. It was all based on modern theories, put drugs in them and all this. But then she met this shaman lady, and the shaman lady was educating her about how actually we're a spirit, soul, or not a body. And the basic problem why everything goes mad is because they don't accept the fact that they're so separated from the spirit soul. They're so separated from themselves that's why they become mad. So she said, yeah, you're a spirit soul, and the spirit soul goes from body to body like this. And she taught her many things, the psychiatrist many things like that. And that when you get in this body, then you have a duty to perform. You're supposed to do something with your life. There's a special goal for you when you're stuck in the body. Each body you get born into, you have a special goal. She actually categorized it that each human being has a special mission in his life. And it's basically six missions. You could have one of the six missions. One was healer. Another one was teacher. Another one was wise man, like that. Another was a protector of people. Another was activator, one who gets movements and things started, you know, like kind of kshatriya or something like that. A very active person, gets things started. There's five. There's one more, I think. I forgot what it was. Prophet. I mean, prophet. And prophet, one who's
and gives advice about the future.
Basically, you got six types of people. Human beings are born with these six types of missions, one of these. And every person's got one of these missions in life, and that's what they're supposed to fulfill themselves in this lifetime. And one may advance from one to the other, whatever. Basically, they're all concerned with higher principles. In other words, they're all concerned with helping others and developing one's spiritual nature, basically. And a human being is put for that purpose, but usually we can't remember. And then the shaman lady said that there is another spirit there who's trying to give you advice all the time. trying to give you hints about what to do or whatever, but we don't want to listen, usually. That's the problem. her observations are, you know, quite in line with the Vedic teachings about Paramatma and everything like that, spirit soul, and ignorance of our spiritual identity and problems that arise from that, etc. In this way, the psychiatrist understood that though that shaman lady looked very primitive, you know, they're dressed in their skin robes and they got their little drums and, you know, they speak a different language and they live up in the mountains and the snowy hills like that. And they don't talk to people and they're chanting all sorts of strange things, mantras, and they're curing people. And she saw her cure people also of diseases just using her drum and things like that. And she was shocked when she saw all this because it worked. She was able to cure people that she couldn't cure. Somehow the shaman lady was able to enter into her mind, into her dreams and everything, and teach her in that way. She had special powers, in other words. It was, you know, very mystical powers of some sort. And she could appear and disappear and do all sorts of things. So anyway, then the psychiatrist understood that actually she looks very primitive, but actually, you know, this culture is very advanced. And where did it come from? You know, it's not a modern culture. It's coming down from, you know, way, way past, in the past. Yeah. From a primitive culture over, you know, 12,000 years ago or something way back then. This is just to show that, you know, the remnants of a previous culture look like they're there in her also, in these cultures. And its basis is spiritual also. It's a spiritual culture. But now, of course, it's all kind of, you know, lost or forgotten or whatever. And so that's just some sort of evidence there. But if we look around the world, we'll find the remnants everywhere. Remnants of this recognition of spirit, soul versus matter and everything. And that we do have definite spiritual goals rather than material goals. Evidence of previous civilizations, etc. there. And these things get created and destroyed periodically. So we'll get the destructions of ice ages and whatever happening. We get these destructions here, you know, happening all the time on smaller cycles and on bigger cycles. And you're going to have them every billions of years. You're going to have the nighttime of Brahma coming also. And every 71 yuga cycles, you get a mini destruction there with the end of the Manvantara, and a new Manvantara beginning 14 times in one day of Brahma. Whole world is going on with that creation and destruction. Within that, the human beings and the other creatures are, you know, coming up and going down, coming up and going down like this. Within that, they're struggling for, you know, spiritual development, basically, under the plan of the Lord. Any question there?
I also have a bit of a problem answering about the dinosaurs. I had heard that they were left over from the last Kali Yuga. I find it hard to explain that. That's so, so long ago.
What do they date them at? How many millions?
They didn't date them that long, did they?
Millions.
Yeah, they date them only back to, like, what is it?
40 million.
50 million.
Is it? Oh, well. The previous Kali Yuga was only, 4 million? No. Yeah, it's 4 million years. The whole cycle is only 4 million years. So it would have to be several Kali Yugas back.
Well, they didn't about that long, did they?
I don't know. You have to see when the dinosaur age was after the Carboniferous period, whenever that was. But the whole Yuga cycle is only, 4 million years. 4 million something years, actually. So I don't know when you're going to place the dinosaurs, whatever. I don't know the ages there. Probably you look in the Forbidden Archaeology. It gives a table there of the different ages and how long they last. You have a Cretaceous period and a Carboniferous period and all these different periods coming up.
They found a human body in Forbidden Archaeology. 3 billion years
in the
coal sediment.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually the same as
which
proves all the sites. It's completely
weird.
It's about the same time in the Vedic time
when the sun god passed it down, and when everything started. Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, that's the beginning of the day of Brahma, I think, isn't it? That's the beginning of the day of Brahma, the 3 million. That's his lifetime. That's his lifetime. 300 trillion years is his lifetime. So I guess the day of Brahma is a few billion or something like that.
Yeah.
1,000 times 4 million is one day of Brahma.
Yeah, that's a human skeleton. That's older than any of the dinosaurs.
Yeah. Well, they found the footprints also, the human footprints next to the dinosaur. Fossils and all these things, so it gets a little strange now.
In the previous Kali, was there modern science, like computers and all that?
In previous ages?
In previous Kali.
Kali Yuga. Were there computers? We don't know, because the records aren't there anymore. Possibly there were, we don't know. Huh? According to the... they may not even need them. According to some people, like the Atlantis civilization was very advanced materially, very materially advanced. But then I think they made some spiritual problems there, and then that's why they got crashed. They crashed. They used the scientific things for the wrong purposes, or something like that. So therefore, so they look like materially they're quite advanced. So maybe they had something more than computers then, even then, more advanced than that. Of course, we see in the even in the Bhagavatam, sometimes we see like the Asuras got the spaceships. They're flying around up in the sky with these huge ships and things like that. So the Asuras definitely have that. Where they come from, we don't know. It seems they have those things. And of course, the modern flying saucer is there also, floating around in the sky, which is more advanced than what we got now. Definitely. The thing about the flying saucers is that the speed is phenomenal, and they can change direction instantaneously, and they can disappear also.
Yeah.
And the modern ones are very strange, that they've videographed, and now is that they change shape before your eyes. They start changing shape, and they start dividing up into two, or three, or four, and then they merge back together again and do all sorts of strange things.
So these flying saucers, they break the laws of gravity on Earth.
Does that mean
that what we learned is not...
Well, it's not that it's nonsense, but somehow they overcome the effects, because technically the way they move, you probably wouldn't be able to survive that technically, because of the forces of gravity and stuff, and going suddenly just turn around and go in the opposite direction, your body would just fall apart, I think. So it looks as if they've kind of gone, apparently it looks by that, if they are coming from other universes or from somewhere, we don't know where they're coming from. Obviously, they have ways of traveling which are beyond what we know about in terms of our time and space.
Currently, we have probes from Earth. It could be 11 months, but like Challenger.
Oh, going up to Mars or whatever.
No, they sent back photos as it's gone through all the 7 planets. We sent Voyager. That's another thing. Yeah, Voyager is like, what's the 5th planet on?
After Mars?
After Mars, yeah.
Jupiter.
And it filmed 23 moons.
The moons of Jupiter.
Saw all that. It was an unmanned spaceship.
Yeah.
It was just traveling and traveling. It was sent off in 82.
Yeah, and it's just getting there now.
Yeah,
so these things that I found
out, he says that there's beams and there could be probes. And then he says that they have to have an alien in their life.
Steer
it. You
know?
Oh, I
should
go up there?
So then it could, like,
return
right angles at G forces, that there's
no beam.
No beam. Yeah.
No, it's 3000 BC, right?
3000 something, yeah.
Is that the date that the so-called Sarasvati, Indo-Sarasvati civilization came to an end, the so-called the decline?
Let's see. I don't know when it. Sometime around that period, it looks like it. Yeah. Looks like around that time. Something around that time, yeah.
That compared to the time? Is that the time the Kauravas and the Pandavas were living?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly the beginning of Kali Yuga. So okay. Just before then, that's when they had the battle of Kurukshetra also.
So they considered this particular civilization, this particular people that lived in the end of the Sarasvati Valley?
Who? Are they considered the Vedic period? Well, there's a big controversy among modern scholars about this. Who were they, the Indus Valley people? Some people say they were the Dravidians. Some people say they were the Vedic people and whatever. And that they were driven out by the Vedic people or something like that, or suppressed, and they came to South India or whatever. That theory's not there now because they were never driven out of anything. The civilization died out because the water sources dried up. And in the Saraswati River, basically that's what happened. It went dry. That's the present theory. So, and they haven't really deciphered the script so much that they've got a few things going now, but they haven't really deciphered the script either. But it is somehow related, I think, with the Vedic script. There's some relationship, I think, there. But nobody really knows, really. But there's very great similarity because they have fire sacrifice. It looks like they have altars. They have lots of water. They believe in purity by water, which is Vedic also. So there's quite a lot of similarities to the Vedic culture. So probably it was the Vedic culture or something like that. Yeah. Or maybe the remnants of the Vedic culture.
When there's, let's say, the end of the day of Brahma, and the partial annihilation,
yeah,
certain planetary systems,
yeah,
where do all the jivas on those systems, where do they all go?
Well, the lower planets are inundated with water, I think up to Maharloka. Svarga goes under, and then above that, so the people from Svargaloka, I think, go up to Maharloka. They go upwards. Where the human beings go, I don't know what happens at that time. But in any case, everybody goes to sleep anyway, so it's not a big deal. Those that are still alive go to sleep anyway, and then the next day everything's back to normal, and then Brahma has to create everything and put jivas back in the bodies again. That's basically it. You create the bodies again for them, and the planetary systems, which are not destroyed, you just put them in the proper order and populate them again, basically. So where they go is probably, I don't know, everybody has to go to sleep anyway, so... Temporarily, for 3 trillion years.
And actually, at the end of his lifetime, Brahma, is that when
they all merge into Mahavishnu? Yeah. Maybe they go into Garbhodakshaya Vishnu or something at that time. Brahma's night. I don't know what happens then.
Is there growing acceptance of within the archaeological field?
Well, as things are getting discovered, it looks like a lot of things it's in a big flux now, you know. So many theories are getting toppled. Like the theory was that the Indians came from Asia at a certain point over a land bridge so many thousands of years ago, and they're the present population, and they were the first people to get to the North American continent. But now that theory, I think, has been disproven by DNA samples from certain, you know, corpses that they found, fossil records or whatever, of petrified things in America, because they're not from Asian sources, those DNA sources. They're more European and old also. So it looks like some European cultures were also there in ancient times as well in America. So there's, you know, all sorts of contradictory evidence coming out from so many sources of our present theories about everything. So nobody's quite sure what to do now, I think. It's just kind of waiting for the next discovery. Not to keep changing everything so quickly. I know. It's an interesting period now that so many discoveries are coming up in the last few years, you know, about ancient civilizations.
And also, I if you had any civilizations that did have synthetic materials like plastic, or, you know, things that we consider a modern material, anything over a few billion years, even plastic disintegrates into nothing. There'd be no evidence. So they could have, they might have been computers and the things made from things like that.
The other thing, of course, is we're looking for fossil evidence, but fossil evidence, of course, is very rare. So, you know, not everything fossilizes. Very few things fossilize, actually. So, and then the human beings are much rarer than the other things, you know, like the shellfish and all that stuff. So, you know, to get a human being fossil of that age is also going to be very, 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 very rare. And if, the other thing, of course, if people buried their, they burned their bodies and they didn't bury them, then you wouldn't get fossils for those people anyway. So, you know, there's a lot of factors there. And the other thing, of course, is that civilization doesn't necessarily mean that simply because you got plastic and radios that you're civilized. You know? That's not the other thing. That you could be very advanced, like in Satyuga. They don't have to have all this advanced. They could be living in the forest. But they can be very advanced because spiritually, you know, and they understand so much more than we know. But we may think, oh, they're looking like cavemen. They're living like cavemen because they're living so simply. But the rishis live in caves, but that doesn't mean they're not civilized. Yogis live in caves even now in the Himalayas. Does it mean they're not civilized? No. So our whole idea about, you know, what is advancement, non-advancement, is also a little bit, you know, prejudiced. Just like we'll say that they, you know, these shamans are primitive people, but you know this psychiatrist found out she was more advanced than she was, and the shaman knew more than she knew. It was on a much higher level, actually, even though she looked so primitive. Okay, Hare Krishna.